columnist. Thank you both for joining us. Coming up, Congressmember Ilhan Omar on President Trump's widening crackdown on immigrants and protesters. Stay with us.
No home, I'm just a roaming round, just a wandering worker. I go from town to town, and the police make it hard for me no matter where I go. And I ain't got no home in this world anymore. And my sisters are stranded on this road, long and dusty road that a million feet have trod. Now the rich man took my home and drove me from my door, and I ain't got no home in this world anymore.
I ain't got no home in this world anymore, a rendition by Billy Bragg in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh in New York.
And I am Amy Goodman in Washington, D.C.
President Trump can keep control of some 4,000 National Guard troops deployed around Los Angeles for now. Late Thursday, an appeals court stayed an earlier order to return authority to Governor Gavin Newsom, which had found Trump's federalizing of California National Guard troops was, quote, illegal. Trump has said he's going to do this in a number of cities around the country. A three-judge panel will hear the case again on Tuesday. This comes as immigrant rights protests continue in Los Angeles, and mass protests are planned nationwide this Saturday in more than 2,000 cities, towns, and villages. People are calling it No King's Day. On the same day, President Trump is hosting a military parade in Washington, D.C. to celebrate his 79th birthday. On Thursday, we spoke about all of this and more with Democratic Congressmember Ilhan Omar of Minnesota. She's the first Somali American elected to the U.S. House of Representatives and one of the first Muslim women in Congress, along with Rashida Tlaib of Michigan.
As Congressmember Ilhan Omar joined us from the Cannon Rotunda, just a little ways down the road from where I am right now, I began by asking her about the troops in the streets in Los Angeles, the thousands of National Guard, the Marines, and tanks rolling through the Capitol ahead of President Trump's military parade, which is happening on June 14th, on his 79th birthday. Abrams tanks will roll through the streets. Some are saying this parade could cost taxpayers up to $100 million. I asked the congressmember to talk about the militarization of the country right now, and also to tie it to her memoir, which is titled This Is What America Looks Like, My Journey from Refugee to Congresswoman.
We are in the midst of the creation of a police state where, you know, you have masked armed men who are in plain clothes that are snatching people off the streets, unwilling to identify themselves. You have the military being deployed in our streets. My God, this is America. You have states' rights being disregarded. So, you know, a constitutional crisis that's being created in front of our eyes. And the same week where we have a president who has deployed the military, who are trained to kill our enemies, not Americans, but our enemies, are in our streets. It's the same week that we are going to have a military parade. Can you imagine that image? that is going to be coming out of our country. I mean, I grew up in a dictatorship. And I don't even remember ever witnessing anything like that. To have a democracy, a beacon of hope for the world to now be turned into one of the worst countries where the military are in our streets without any regard for people's constitutional rights, while our president is spending millions of dollars propping himself up like a failed dictator with a military parade, it is really shocking, and it should be a wake-up call for all Americans to say this is not the country we were born in. This is not the country we believe in. This is not the country our founding fathers imagined. And this is not the country that is supported by our Constitution, our ideals, our values. And we should all collectively be out in the streets rejecting what is taking place this week.
Representative Omar, President Trump has issued an extremely dire warning to anyone who protests on the day itself, Saturday, in Washington, D.C. This is what he said.
And we're going to be celebrating big on Saturday. We're going to have a lot of, and if there's any protester that wants to come out, they will be met with very big force. By the way, for those people that want to protest, they're going to be met with very big force. And I haven't even heard about a protest, but, you know, this is people that hate our country, but they will be met with very heavy force.
So, Congressmember Omar, your response to what he said, and also this very dangerous point he makes that protesters are those who hate this country.
I mean, I think the person who is in the process of destroying our country should look in the mirror, and that's Trump, and notice that he is the one that has hatred for the values that we have here in America and everything that we have built. The reality is protest, dissent, is constitutionally protected. That is the everybody's First Amendment right in this country, and the fact that we have a president that is threatening to use heavy force, which, again, begs the question, is he going to send people, you know, is the police going to be that heavy force? Is the military going to be that heavy force? What is a heavy force? And why, all of a sudden, are Americans not allowed to exercise their First Amendment rights? And again, this should be alarming to Americans to understand that we are headed towards a dangerous path, and it will be a dark day if we do not stand up for ourselves, for our Constitution, and for our republic.
And Congressman Omar, you've actually been very vocal in another deeply unconstitutional move that the Trump administration has made, namely the picking up and detaining of students who protested the policies of Israel in Gaza. You've said dissent is constitutionally protected, which of course it is, and that what's happening now in the U.S. is effectively a constitutional coup. So if you could talk about specifically what happened to those students and what role you see the courts playing in dissenting and arguing against what the Trump administration is trying to do.
Yeah. I've been tickled a little bit by the idea that as an immigrant, I care about the Constitution more than many of my colleagues, who seem to think, you know, constitutional protections in this country are only for those who are citizens and have not really read or understood that regardless of what your status is in this country, that you have due process, that you have access to constitutional rights. And what we are seeing is people who, you know, write an op-ed saying the genocide in Gaza should end, people who protest, people who have become a spokesperson for young people in college who are standing up. are somehow a threat to our national security and foreign policy, what they are a threat to is the status quo of continuing to do the same thing and being complacent with a genocide that's happening in Gaza with our tax dollars. And I think it's really important to also remember that almost every single person that has been detained, that they did not ship in the middle of the night. The courts have intervened, and including people like Mahmoud Khalil, the courts have said he cannot be deported and he needs to be released. And they have until the 13th of this month, which is tomorrow, to facilitate his release from detention. And, you know, the Maryland man that they took to El Salvador, to that dungeon, he has been returned. And I know that there are pressing charges against him, but the reality of why they returned him is that they understood that they would be held in contempt of court because the Supreme Court said they have to facilitate his return. And so they are fabricating a case in order to save face, because they continue to say that they are not able to get him back into the country, and quickly realized that they are going to be in trouble. So all this chaos is wasting taxpayer dollar. It is creating chaos. It is jamming up our court systems that have real work in front of them. But it is not doing the thing that they want it to do, because we are a constitutional republic and our constitution will hold.
Ask you, Congressmember Omar, about what happened on Monday, 75 House Democrats voting in support of a resolution that included a line praising ICE, expressing, quote, gratitude to law enforcement officers, including U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement personnel, for protecting the homeland. You are trying to pass a law that holds police accountable for violence against protesters. I was wondering if you can talk about the bill that you introduced in May, and also the Trump administration's move to lift the consent decrees holding police accountable, including your own home city of Minneapolis.
Yeah, I mean, people who take an oath to serve and protect should be held accountable when they cause harm in our communities. And right now, the only remedy that exists for a lot of people when police brutalize them is to sue the city and get some money while that police officer continues to be on the force and does not face any criminal charges. Just the fact that you wear a uniform and wear a badge does not mean you have a right to harm people who are out doing, participating in protests. That is their constitutional right to be able to do so. So our legislation gets at that. It is unfortunate that, you know, some Democrats keep falling into this trap in supporting legislation because they do not have the ability to stand up for what they believe, and that is why we are lacking credibility as a party. Because, you know, when we say we are for the protection of immigrants, that we are for creating a humane immigration policy, that we want to protect our neighbors, and then you have members of the Democratic Party in Congress take that vote that they took, it becomes a little hard for people to believe that we are sincere in the policies that we push for. So I do hope that my colleagues realize that they are causing more harm to the credibility of Democrats when they are wishy-washy on some of these policies than they are doing to help the country secure its borders and have an immigration policy that is just.
That was Representative Ilhan Omar, Minnesota Congressmember. We spoke with her on Thursday. Coming up, we look at the Trump administration's dismantling of U.S. aid and what it means for people around the world to lose this critical lifeline. Stay with us. by Lila Downs performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh in New York.
And I am Amy Goodman in Washington, D.C. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has ordered the termination of all remaining overseas employees of the U.S. Agency of International Development, USAID, or USAID, to complete the dismantling of the six-decade-old agency. USAID was an early target of Elon Musk and DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency. Meanwhile, the House voted Thursday to approve President Trump's request to claw back $8.3 billion in previously enacted funding for foreign assistance from USAID and the African Development Foundation. The request seeks to make permanent the cuts to foreign aid already imposed by Elon Musk's DOGE. Oxfam America warns those cuts could cause 23 million children to lose access to education, while up to 95 million people could lose access to basic health care, potentially leading to over 3 million preventable deaths per year. This comes as researchers at Boston University estimate the Trump administration's massive cuts to the U.S. Agency for International Development have already led to some 300,000 deaths. Billionaire Elon Musk called on Trump to shut down USAID earlier this year.
And USAID is a ball of worms. Mm-hmm. There is no apple. Mm-hmm. And when there is no apple, you've just got to basically get rid of the whole thing.
For more on the dismantling of USAID and what it means for people around the world, we're joined now by two guests. In Oslo, Jan Egeland is with us with the Norwegian Refugee Council. He's just returned from a trip to Mozambique. And here in New York, we're joined by Amanda Klassing, National Director of Government Relations and Advocacy with Amnesty International USA, which has just released a report titled Lives at Risk: Chaotic and Abrupt Cuts to Foreign Aid Put Millions of Lives at Risk. Welcome to Democracy Now! Amanda Klassing, let's begin with you. If you could outline the main findings of your report, the effects of these U.S. aid cuts.
Yeah, absolutely. So we wanted to make sure that there's a full accounting of the impact on lives around the world. And in the immediate term, we wanted to give a preview of case studies in 12 countries. What does it look like for there to be such chaotic and in many ways cruel cuts to programs? We looked at programs in Haiti where services for children that have been victims of sexual violence by the gangs, they're not able to access the funding that they were going to provide for, in particular, girls. Or they aren't able to continue the prevention and services for people living with HIV that are LGBT or sex workers that have been displaced by gangs. We also looked in countries like Afghanistan, where internally displaced services for internally displaced people have been cut dramatically, and it's leading to women not having access to safe spaces, people losing jobs, including women, the very few jobs left for them. We looked at Yemen, which is one of the biggest humanitarian crises in the world, and looking at the different services for girls and survivors of sexual violence that have been cut and impacted, including, again, safe spaces, psychosocial support. In Myanmar, we looked at the Thai-Burma border. We talked to somebody who actually saw IVs being ripped out of arms when the stop work order came down, and people having to leave hospitals. It's just, there's so much about the big data that is out there and speculation about what this will mean in the long term. But in the short term, the rollout of this policy had devastating impacts already on lives. And Secretary Rubio is defiant. Testimony that said that lives haven't been lost. It just defies logic.
Well, let's actually talk about exactly what he said, Secretary of State Rubio, and I'd like to get your comment and also Jan Egeland, whose organization, Norwegian Refugee Council, works with aid groups and populations in need all over the world. Exactly what Rubio said before the House Foreign Affairs Committee, claiming no one has died because of USAID cuts, the cutoff of billions of dollars of U.S. support for global health programs, another congressional hearing hearing, he said, no children are dying on my watch. Amanda, first you, then Jan Egeland.
Again, it just defies logic. We have the estimates of the people that have been cut off from aid, cut off from life-saving care. We talked to a program in Guatemala. So you have to understand Guatemala has extraordinarily high rates of sexual violence against girls. Over 4,000 girls a year become pregnant and have very little access to abortion services, and so almost all of them carry their pregnancies to term. There was a program that provided safe nutrition and high quality food to these pregnant girls that got cut off. Now, those numbers might not come in right now in front of Secretary Rubio, but certainly the lives of these girls have been impacted. We have individual stories that when you put them all together, you see that it just is at best, it is a lack of faith to the truth. At worst, it's just outright lies.
So, Jan Egeland, how would you characterize what the U.S. Secretary of State said, Marco Rubio, when he said, no children are dying on my watch? Give us a global view, and then you just came from Mozambique. Talk about what's happening there.
My organization, the Norwegian Refugee Council, works in 40 countries that is stricken by war and disasters. We're a frontline organization. And I must say, I and my frontline humanitarian works have always been very impressed with U.S. aid, the Bureau of Humanitarian Assistance, their work, and the very timely aid they have given us and multiple other organizations that are saving lives. We, in our case, give emergency relief to nearly 10 million displaced people. In northern Mozambique, which is the emergency that the world forgot, hundreds of thousands are fleeing violence from the Islamic State of Mozambique. I mean, Islamic State is defined by the U.S. and other Western countries as a very bad terror organization. On top of that, they had three cyclones in the beginning of the year, all climate-induced, climate-driven, and these are very poor people. They did nothing to cause climate change. What they see, however, is that companies from North America and from Europe are pumping gas and oil and taking precious materials, minerals, from their soil. So when I then also see that the aid cuts that are going most abruptly from the U.S., but also other donors. But the U.S. was 60% of humanitarian aid in this region, 60%. And then to go from 60% to zero means that the water towers in the camp I was had not been filled. This was an infrastructure paid for by American taxpayers, saving lives because clean drinking water is life-saving. It is empty now. The latrines are overflowing. People have to relieve themselves around the camp. It would lead to epidemic disease. Some of it may spread outside of the camp, to the nation, to the region, to the world. No, it's not the way to build a railroad to take away the biggest aid program in the world. Overnight, we're working to get other nations to fill these gaps. We get aid from 40 different donor nations and international organizations. But when the biggest one leaves overnight, it really leaves a gaping hole in life-saving aid.
And what about your response, Jan Egeland, to the fact that the Trump administration maintains that life-saving aid is exempt from these cuts? What is happening in practice, though, on the ground?
Well, what is happening in reality is that they have left completely Mozambique. They have left completely Afghanistan. They have left nearly completely the Democratic Republic of Congo, where they were also the largest donor. And what we're then asking is others to step up. But again, I mean, Norway has 5.5 million inhabitants. We pay five times more per taxpayer and foreign assistance. five times more. It's more than 1% of gross national income goes to foreign aid, 0.2% from the U.S. So it's an average nation, the U.S., in terms of what one is giving per tax payer. And now if U.S. is leaving international solidarity and compassion completely, they will violate every Christian ideal, every humanist ideal, every ideal of every philosophy and religion. I don't think it will happen. U.S. has traditionally been one of the more generous nations when children around the world are starving.
Well, precisely, Jan Egeland, I would like to get both of you to respond to this. The fact, the monumental improvements in both child and maternal health as a direct consequence of humanitarian aid delivered by the U.S. over the last 30 years. If you could talk about that, and then, Amanda, we'd like to get your response as well.
No, I mean, it's fantastic what the U.S. has achieved. Limiting the spread of AIDS, limiting the spread of epidemic disease, making education there for youth that have left, that had no hope, and get hope. Give one other example as well. I mean, I saw that the U.S. were giving, through the Norwegian Refugee Council, business grants to displaced families. A business grant was $260, not a very large sum, but it led the baker who had fled from Islamic State terror to a camp. He could resume becoming a baker. He has now a business. He sells 300 breads every morning, and he has employed a widow and another very poor family man to work with him. I mean, the U.S. has a lot to be proud of because of its aid. It has traditionally been in the fourth, it's been the leader of humanitarian aid, and it should remain so. We're not giving up hope to see the U.S. again coming back to the ideals that has been there for all Republican and Democratic administrations since the Second World War.
And Amanda Clasing, your response to, in particular, this issue of maternal and child health.
Yeah, absolutely. What's incredible is that the U.S. has also funded the wraparound kind of services and programs that are required to really address the drivers of maternal health. And so there have been programs and safe spaces, programs to address gender-based violence, programs to increase gender equality, programs to increase girls' education, programs to support women leaders and women human rights defenders. All of these programs that aren't necessarily health programs have led to addressing the very stubborn reasons why there continues to be high rates of maternal death in countries around the world, or infant mortality. So increasing all of the quality of life issues and women's rights issues in countries around the world also address maternal mortality. And that, for sure, are the types of programs that there is no interest in returning to. And that is part of why we're so concerned that that's not going to be included.
Amanda Clasing, Amnesty International, thank you so much for joining us. And Jan Egeland in Oslo, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council. And that does it for our show. We're hiring a senior headline news producer, a director of audience, and a director of technology. Find out more at our website, democracynow.org. Jobs. I'm Nermeen Sheikh in New York, joined by Amy Goodman in Washington, D.C. for another edition of Democracy Now!
Every Friday from 1 to 2 p.m., tune in to Department Uno to hear the latest and greatest from the CJSF playlist, featuring all new music from local, Canadian, and international artists. Fresh releases from the music department every week on Department Uno, only on CJSF 90.1 FM.
TJ.